And welcome to another episode of the O3C podcast coming to you from O3C Games. My name is Jonathan Dunn. That rude man interrupting me is Chris Dow.
That's me.
And we are going around the world in 80 games. Announcement! Announcement! Good morrow, fellow gamers. If you like discussions about games, which I'm sure you do if you're listening to this podcast, then please head over and join us in the O3C Discord. You can find the join link on our website, o3c.games. Whilst you're there, check out some of the other stuff on the website, like our videos and articles, and if you're so inclined, check out the support page. Here you can send us a financial donation via PayPal, pledge a regular donation to our Patreon, or just find quick, easy links to share the podcast on your social media platforms. Any or all of those things really go a long way to help keep the show going, and we'd be hugely appreciative of any or said all of those above things being done. Hello, and welcome to April! It's April the 1st. Yes.
Yes.
It is April the 1st. We are two fools. Both pushing 40.
Yes.
This is not an April Fool's Day episode like we did a few years ago. Still continues to amuse me, that one. If anyone listening hasn't heard that, check it out on our website or scroll back far enough on your podcast feed because it's very, very silly. Instead, this month, we are heading to a brand new destination to explore their gaming history, their development and output. And that place is New Zealand.
New Zealand.
Heck of a lot of air miles racked up with this one, and I can't wait to just get right up to my Kiwis in it. But first, me and you, Chris, we have a month's worth of gaming activity to catch up with. Shall we start with the headlines?
I thought I'd list a few games that I've emulated this last month. I have played Enchanted Arms, which was From Software's oft-forgotten RPG with grid-based combat that was on the Xbox 360. So I'm playing that via emulation. Xbox 360 stuff doesn't always run great on the Steam Deck and anywhere, to be honest. It's still kind of an emulator in its infancy. But this does run pretty much perfectly. Yeah. Having a nice time. I've played a decent chunk of a game called Magus, which was an Atlus-published action RPG that everyone hated on launch for the PS3. Again, emulated. And I've played a PlayStation 1 racing game called C3, Car Constructors Championship. And they're all good fun. Enchanted Arms is a reasonably vanilla RPG from the start of the 360's life, but it's kind of a standout because it fits so awkwardly alongside most of FromSoft's oeuvre, especially their modern stuff. It really does not fit that well alongside kind of, you know, the Souls series and Armored Core and the other stuff they're kind of most famous for. But I quite enjoy it. I had it back when I had my 360. I never finished it completely. I've tried a couple times since, and at the moment I'm just picking through a few battles here and there and making minor progress through the story, but that's fun. Magus on the PS3 was shot down when it came up for being shallow and clunky and pretty poorly written. And yeah, if I paid £40 for it then, I probably would have been a bit down on it as well. But for zip, for no pounds, you know, it's a knockabout third-person action game. It tries to move something like Diablo, say, into full 3D. You shoot a million copycat enemies, you upgrade your gear, you rinse and repeat. And it's mindless, runs well, decent time. Of the three games, though, C3, the racing game, is the real treat here, for me at least.
Of course it is.
It's a racing game that feels a bit like Sega Rally in its slidey handling. It's got a much more analog approach than that game, though, seeing as accelerate and brake are mapped to up and down on the right analog stick, which is really odd. It feels like you're sort of controlling a remote control racing game or something like that, like a little RC car. For the first few races, I hated it, and I was fiddling around in the back end trying to map it to triggers instead to make it feel a bit more natural. But once I got used to it, it gives way more control than you're kind of used to.
Yeah.
And it lets you really kind of carefully feather the power around corners to pull off some really nice, satisfying drifts. So if you like rally games from that sort of era, if you like wobbly polygons, if you like warping textures and strange control schemes, all in on that one.
It's mad, actually, because that's the first time I've actually heard of a control system for a racing game that isn't binary of start and stop.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was Motor Storm, which was like a racing series on the PS3. It had a spin-off that was RC Cars, and that was on the Vita, and that controlled in the same way. With the
I assume these were just cars that gave you a really bad attitude.
Yes.
Just really RC.
Yeah, yeah. Following on from last episode, I also finished Lumines and Rez's Retro Achievement sets 100%. Felt very good for doing so. Great time. Finally, and not emulation, in the current Steam sale, which of course, when this has gone live, will be long past, but you know, we are time travelers in a sense. I bought a whole bunch of stuff naturally, including the Animal Crossing Aping Disney Dreamlight Valley.
Oh.
And I'd been interested in seeing what it offered for a while, but I didn't want to pay full price. And despite it having some mobile-style premium content, which is never a great look for a paid game that also has a paid expansion, it's a really nice tick list experience, similar to kind of what I was enjoying in Farm Together when I was playing that last year. Bought it on Saturday. It's now Monday. I've somehow already played it for nearly 20 hours. So I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. You know,
I'm not a Disney person. I couldn't give two shits who was running about asking me to do tasks. But it doesn't have any of the kind of mobile timers for energy. There's no limit on what you can do. You can just carry on working, carry on harvesting stuff, carry on building stuff. So it's very hard to put down once you start.
Yeah.
And as long as you're not going to get swept up thinking, but I really need this Monsters, Inc. armoire or something that costs an extra pound or two of real money. There's a huge amount of game there if you just enjoy that kind of cozy, you know, tick things off a list sort of experience. So I'll probably report back more in a month if I'm still playing, but having a nice time at the moment.
It's on Apple Arcade.
It is.
There's no in-app purchases in Apple Arcade games. So hopefully there's a decent sort of balance where it's not just totally taken out a whole bunch of content.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah.
I did look it up specifically for you for that reason. And everything I read said it controls well. It's basically the full game. It's the full paid expansion as well was included in it.
Mm.
The only thing you're not getting is kind of the few premium things that rotate around on the main console version.
And the thing is, I'm absolutely fine with that.
Yeah.
Because it's not in the game and I'm not getting it, you know?
Yeah. And I think the only other thing people said was that if you ever did want to migrate to another console, every other machine has cloud saving. So in theory, you could play it on the Switch and then pick it up on the PC later and then the Xbox later.
Right, yeah.
With the Apple version, it's tied just to the Apple Arcade stuff, so Mac or iOS or whatever.
But then I could play it on my Mac and then on my phone and then on my iPad and then on my Apple TV. And
I would say it's definitely worth trying for nothing if you've already got a subscription.
Yeah.
And seeing what you think, at least. What about you? What are your headlines?
Well, my first headline, and probably the most important of these headlines, because it is proper headline-worthy
news. Calm down.
And that is, Lucas Pope's new game has landed on the playdate.
Oh, yeah. You got to sell me on this one.
Creator of the extraordinary political puzzle solver Papers, Please and the beautifully atmospheric one-bit mystery story Return of the Obra Dinn has delivered a pint-sized experience that is such a wonderful fit for the plucky little yellow handheld. Mars After Midnight riffs on what he'd established in Papers, Please and its demands of observation and memory being utilised to pass through scenarios, but it switched out the bleak, hyper-political Eastern European border control setting to a colony of flatulent aliens on Mars.
Which is an improvement?
It's different. It's brilliant. It's addictive. It's funny. It's satisfying. The technological showcase it is for the system is actually quite understated because it's got so much going on in it, including amazingly detailed, procedurally generated character art.
Oh, wow.
So every single Martian that you're letting into this facility that you're in control of is different every time. But they are like really detailed. They've got bags of personality. It's all presented so slickly and smoothly. It translates into what is a vital playdate experience. It's a must buy.
Yeah.
You must buy it.
I could do the old live purchase again. I might.
It's six I might bucks come back as well. To that later. It's not even like one of the pricier games on there. It's great. It's really fun. I sat on the loo for an hour straight.
Numb legs is the best review for a portable game, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Next headline. I finally finished the single-player campaign on Power Wash Simulator.
Oh, wow. How many hours does that take?
Oh, God knows, actually. Let me have a look. 36 hours?
Oh, bloody hell.
The unreasonably satisfying game was really nice to play for the majority of the campaign. There was one stage in particular that I absolutely hated, which was a Ferris wheel. It was just really fiddly, and you needed just to keep turning the big wheel off and on again to get it to like rotate to access all of the stupid little angles. I really didn't enjoy it, but the fucking enormous ancient pyramid temple final level was great fun. It was enormous, and it was really, really good. I almost certainly will play more of the game in the future because it's quite therapeutic. There's loads of bonus levels that I haven't done yet. I know there's DLC as well, but yeah, it's great. Shouldn't be, but it is. Next headline. A game that I really enjoyed playing through was a little mobile game called Automatoys.
Oh, I don't know that one.
It fulfills my criteria of a perfect mobile game by being one-handed. Able to be played in portrait mode with one finger, and it sees you try and navigate a marble through complex screwball scramble style automatons by triggering certain elements at the right time to move the ball through the course and avoid the traps. It's really good. It's really nicely made. It's a decent challenge. It's never too frustrating, but I definitely, definitely recommend it. I think it was one of those where it was like, you can play the first three levels for free and then you can unlock the final 12 for $1.99. So it may as well be a demo.
Yeah.
Try it if you can. It's lovely. My last headline, I've started a playthrough of Mario Tennis on the Game Boy Color.
Oh, via Switch Online.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It landed on the Game Boy Collection after Mario Day last month. It's a really, really good game. I've only played through it, I think, probably the once, maybe back in the day. Unlike Mario Golf, which is also dropped on there as well. Mario Tennis, it's got such incredibly tight and responsive gameplay. It's just incredibly fun to play, even, what, like 400 years after it's been released? It does obviously have like that brilliant Camelot RPG casing and like leveling up that made Mario Golf so incredible. It's not quite like on the same level as what they did with golf, but it's made up for by this just superb gameplay and also like AI for your doubles partner and also your competitors being like leagues ahead of, honestly, like 99% of any other sports game that exists. It's just brilliant. It's really, really great. And yeah, I'm enjoying sort of going in and out of that to tick that off.
What are you buying? What are you playing?
Oh, so Chris, those were our amuse-bouches. Amusing as they were, what are your main courses?
Well, you're going to need a big boosh for one of these. After playing Pal World last month, you know, a big, contemporary, relevant video game, which is quite unlike me, I thought I'd spend a bit of time this month tackling, or at least trying to scratch the surface of, another big, contemporary, pretty relevant release as well. I installed and spent 15, nearly 20 hours with Bethesda's Starfield.
Oh. Space Rim.
Yeah, basically. My thinking was that because I thoroughly enjoyed The Outer Worlds when I played it, and that was just Obsidian's space-themed take on the Skyrim / Fallout Bethesda formula thing, I wanted to see how Bethesda themselves eventually treated this sort of like NASA punk theming. And internet consensus all over the place on whether it would even run on the Steam Deck, but I gambled that it probably wouldn't faze me too much, even if it was pretty ropey, seeing as I played through all of The Outer Worlds, about 60 plus hours I played that for, on the Nintendo Switch, where frame rates barely held 20, I'd say, in most places. Yeah. And the resolution of the textures and the whole game itself was in the toilet. So I'm pretty happy to report that Starfield looks and runs pretty bloody well on the deck after a bit of tweaking. Like, it's not straight out of the box. You do need to kind of dig in a little bit.
You wouldn't be happy if it did run straight out of the box, would
you? That's half the fun.
Oh, man, yeah.
And whilst it's definitely not the optimal way to play this game, obviously, if you've got a massive rig, if you've got an Xbox Series, whatever, that's going to be better. But if the Steam Deck's what you've got, it's fine. It's fine. The game, then, I am really not sure how best to talk about this one because, one, I'm never that equipped to talk about this sort of game, but also it's really odd how it's been put together for a game of this size and from a studio this size. The core story is interesting, but it does become absurdly far-fetched about 15 minutes into play. Like, it's that quick. So you start off, you're a space miner.
A child.
yes, a child. But yeah, you stumble upon this artifact thing. You have this weird psychedelic out-of-body experience when you touch it. Then when you wake up, a space explorer man visits the mining facility to try and barter for the artifact. And then bounty hunter type people have tailed his ship, which means you're thrust into defending the facility from them. Then the space explorer man, just for no reason at all, says, "Have my ship. Now you're a space explorer man." It's literally that quick. And you take off and the game is kind of then open properly. So that's the equivalent of the Skyrim, you know, have a drive through in the wagon sort of thing at the beginning is this section. The core loop of the game is similar to any modern Bethesda games in the Elder Scrolls or Fallout framework, but it has a few quite crucial caveats that I'll kind of touch on as we go through. even in my very short experience with something like Skyrim, like I've never put more than 2 or 3 hours into it, I could still see how people can really easily buy into like the core hook, the whole like, oh, see that mountain in the distance? Take a walk there in real time and discover treats and caves and treasures along the way. And that's essentially what has then been refined in Breath of the Wild or The Witcher 3 or any of those big kind of open world RPGs. In Starfield, that look at something and then go to it just does not exist, because the way it's all put together, a mission loop will have you talking to a character on one planet and being told to go somewhere else to another planet. You then have to fast travel to your spaceship with a lengthy load time. You then fast travel into orbit with a lengthy load time. You then choose your destination from a star map and warp to a new planet's orbit with another lengthy load time. Because significantly, and this is really, really big, you cannot manually fly between planets like in something like No Man's Sky. And it feels like such a huge oversight that when you're in the orbit of a planet, you are just locked into this little space where you can see the planet and you can't go anywhere else, short of going back to a menu and saying, I would actually like to go there, please.
That's stupid.
It's really, really silly.
That's really stupid.
Once you're hovering above the planet that you intend to land on, you can't fly to it. You have to, again, fast travel to the planet's surface with another lengthy load. You then walk to a destination marker to either kill some people or talk to a guy in a facility or a little space dungeon or whatever it is. And then to get back to say, yes, I've done the job, you have to reverse every one of those steps. So you fast travel back to the ship, back to orbit, back to the other planet's orbit, back to the surface, the whole thing. It's really poorly done for that.
Yeah.
There's no organic traversal in it, really, outside of like walking around little spaces. And by adding this huge scale, like there are hundreds, if not thousands of planets, moons, rocks, all this stuff that you can land on and explore, it actually makes the game feel significantly less populated and full than the Outer Worlds that were set over like 5 planets.
Yeah.
And those planets were like 1 city each.
Yeah.
You know, it really wasn't big, but it felt big for kind of how it was presented, that it's like, oh, this is just a portion of this world.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Starfield says go anywhere and there's fuck all to do and 99% of it.
Yeah.
Like the missions you're sent on can feel a bit undercooked as well. And I was most surprised at that, because everyone has always told me, oh, you know, Skyrim's got this great narrative and you can join a civil war. All these different things that are going on. You know, you arrive on a planet's surface, you walk through this empty terrain until you find maybe a research structure or something. And in one early one, I did just that. I went to a place I was told. I fought off some space pirates. Along the way, I was picking up the classic audio logs and I was seeing the environmental hints, all the stuff you expect. And it turned out, oh, spooky, spooky, the facility's been used to create and monitor like xenomorph-style creatures. And, you know, lo and behold, things went awry. And I was sneaking through the building. I was thinking, okay, well, there's going to be some sort of encounter with an alien at some point. There's going to be some little fight. There's going to be some skirmish between maybe the pirates that are squatting in the facility and the creatures or whatever. But no, they don't exist in any sort of physical space. They exist in the audio logs in the past. So when I got to the top, it was like, oh, that's it, is it? And then just fast travel back to the ship, go home. But it just felt so underwhelming.
Yeah.
There's so many other little things as well that have left me feeling really confused. And again, I always say, I'm not playing these games all the time. This is not the sort of thing I play. So I wonder sometimes, have I just missed out? Is this kind of what these games are like? And I'm the problem here because I just haven't kept up. But the inventory UI, for example, doesn't tell you which ammunition a gun uses. And when you've got 10 guns and we will use different types of ammo, you can't keep track of what you need to fire a weapon. Unless you go back to a different screen of bullets and say like, oh, I had 60 of those. Which gun has 60 bullets in it? You're literally tracking it like that, which is silly to see which numbers align. You land on a planet, you're over-encumbered. When you're over-encumbered, you can't fast travel. And as I said, fast travel is quite important. So you need to go and get rid of all your shit. But shops and merchants only sell or buy certain things. So clearing your over-encumbered inventory is like an hour-long job running around a spaceport to go, where was the suit shop? Where's the gun shop? Yeah. Where's the esoterica shop? Dumb. Just literally give me a thing I can click and just say empty everything that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Everything I'm not wearing, put in the bin. That should be how it works.
Yeah.
There's other things that this is a me problem. The weaponry that you're holding is not disabled in safe towns or areas. So when you've got kind of changing contextual buttons, it's really easy to like launch a load of grenades into a town square. And then you get slapped with like a massive space bounty. That means not only do you get hunted down on that planet, but also in deep space. Sometimes a ship will just turn up and be like, oi! And then try to shoot you down when you're just trying to have a nice little leisurely fly.
Yeah.
Running around, you don't use stamina in this game, but it depletes an oxygen meter, which is fine in principle. But what happens is that when that bottoms out, you then start filling up a carbon dioxide meter. And when that fills up, your health disappears because you're struggling to breathe. So you just start dying. So essentially in this game, you're trying to get to your little facility. There's nothing else on the planet. So you're like, well, I'll run to it, obviously. And it's like, nope, jogging kills you. So you can't do that. This last one, I haven't played enough for this to be an issue yet, but I was reading online that the game also uses a really strange combo of what is like an omniscient contraband system and an XP debt model, which means if you steal stuff, which is always like a big part of Fallout, Skyrim, yeah, whatever, you pickpocket someone, you sneak behind a counter, you take some stuff. When you enter a new planet, your ship is always scanned by the authorities of that planet, and they know immediately if it's stolen property. How? How do they know that's contraband? But then you're given the option, you can either pay a fine, which might be small if it was just like someone's pen, or big if it was like big valuable stuff. Or if you can't afford to pay the fine because you haven't got the money, you take on an experience debt, which means you then don't level up anymore until you've cleared that shortfall. So you don't go backwards, but you can't go forward. Like there's just so many strange undercooked decisions here.
That's
and this
really
is
poor.
This is a game that took thousands of people 10 years to make.
It's really poor.
Miles After Midnight, one guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's so strange that when you're fighting mobs that have overrun these little abandoned structures, or when you're enjoying the really decent voice acting with a range of characters, you get these little glimpses of what the game could have been.
Mm.
But the rest of the time, I've just been left thinking that Starfield is simultaneously too big and too little for its own good. Like it's both. It's this weird microcosm of both things. It's just empty, purposeless exploration. It's half-baked narrative events. It's got wonky AI, as you'd expect in most Bethesda stuff anyway. So sometimes your companions will just run through the floor or fly into space or whatever. It's got these really frustrating loading loops, like getting from one place to another is like a 20-minute job. It's just about the most 5 out of 10 AAA game I can imagine or conjure. You know, there is a game here. You could probably play it for 200 hours and have an okay time. But the whole time you'd be thinking, there's so many things here that could be done better.
Yeah.
And that it comes from one of the biggest and most revered companies with the biggest publishing company behind them in Microsoft.
Yeah.
It's mad, really. It really is mad. So I can't really recommend it. Like, there's times when I've thought, oh, yeah, I'm having a nice time. And then after those little 20-minute chunks, it's like, yeah, I don't think I am.
Yeah.
You know, you just have these moments where you're like, oh, it's so close to being something I could put a lot of time into. And again, I played The Outer Worlds on really subpar hardware for a long time.
Yeah, but
so, it was fun. And it was well written. And I enjoyed the whole narrative and the story and everything else. And this just is not doing that. So, yeah, Bethesda, you fucked it, basically.
So this is a New Zealand episode. And of course, you can't spell New Zealand without Zelda.
Yes. Yeah, I'll give you that.
Or weasel.
Is that true as well?
No, only if you spell weasel with a Z.
Well, I do actually.
So. Because I'm cool.
Weasel Extreme with an X.
But I have been on a bit of a Zelda binge over this last month, spurred on by finishing my season as a guest on the brilliant Chat of the Wild Zelda podcast and our playthrough of A Link Between Worlds, which is such an incredible game. It was very ballsy of Nintendo to return to the beloved Link to the Past world with this sort of semi-sequel for the 3DS, because it had been a really long time since they've made a classic top-down Zelda game, and it's a huge gamble to deliberately welcome comparison to probably the most revered Zelda game of all time. It was a swing, but it was a big old hit.
Yeah.
A Link Between Worlds builds on what Link to the Past established, chucks in a genius new mechanic that literally and mentally changes your perspective on how you're meant to play Zelda games, and also smashes down the more linear doors of the history of the entire series with a brand new game structure, which also lays the groundwork for what was to come in Breath of the Wild. Much, much more than any of the bigger 3D console Zelda outings did. Do check out the Chat of the Wild podcast if you want to hear further thoughts on that game in particular. And you can also listen back to their other seasons covering the other Zelda games, including the playthrough of Spirit Tracks, on which I was also a season-long guest.
Choo-choo!
That game is rancid. But finishing A Link Between Worlds made me want to revisit some of the other 2D Zelda games, and I dove headfirst into a new playthrough of the Minish Cap.
Oh, the GBA one.
The GBA one, which is on the Nintendo Switch Online collection. And my flipping goodness me, I'd forgotten just how incredibly charming, joyous, and fun this game is. For a start, as a technical achievement, the game is absolutely stunning. Like, every single pixel of this game has been considered to create just the most vibrant, detailed, and alive world that they'd ever made at this point. Every little character has delightful animation. Then you've got the tiny miniature world of the Pecori, which has got like huge versions of tiny things in real life, brought to life in like beautiful detail, gives you just this amazing sense of perspective that is just so endearing. The movement mechanics that you have as Link in Minish Cap gave him a freedom that I hadn't seen or experienced in a 2D Zelda game before. For a start, you can roll with a tap of the right shoulder button. That just immediately makes moving around more dynamic. It's such a simple thing, but just being able to do that just makes getting around just more interesting, more fun. And you can use it in combat as well to dodge, use the iframes to avoid obstacles and projectiles and stuff. And then you also get a bunch of combat mechanics, including, yeah, like the classic sword spin attack, but also that upgrades to allow bigger and longer spinning. You get like a roll and thrust attack. You get an item called the Rock's Cape that allows you to jump and glide. And then you can get an attack that adds in like a drop plunge sword thing. And it's incredible how much stuff you can do with a still fairly limited amount of buttons. It's mad that the GBA only just had an A and B button. I mean, obviously, yeah, the shoulder buttons are a good addition, but like the lack of four face buttons does also kind of cause the only gripe that I have with this game, which is the fact that you have to switch items out all the time because you basically you have to always have your sword assigned to one of the buttons, and then you need to switch your other item out constantly, which it's not as infuriating as it probably would be because it's all just so much fun to play. And also, I'm kind of used to that being the setup for how you play a 2D Zelda game. But Minish Cap is so, so good. Dungeons are brilliant. The items are great. The sense of scale and puzzle solving are just ingenious. I haven't even mentioned my favourite mechanic in the game, which is the Kinstones mechanic. Throughout the game, you'll find lots of different medallion halves. And these will be different colours and also have like a different pattern cut along the edge of it. Then you need to find someone in the game with the corresponding kinstone to match with them. And then a successful match will bond you with the person and unlock a secret in the overworld, which might be, I don't know, like spawning a chest or opening a hidden cave or removing an obstacle to open up a new pathway or creating a special character or enemy or any other thing. It's always fun to do. It's always fun to find a kinstone. And the very, very best thing is, if you've shrunk down into like Minish form and you're tiny, when you're tiny, you can talk to the animals that are in the world and you can match kinstones with them. And the fact that you can bond with dogs that are in the game and unlock secrets, it honestly makes this one of the greatest games of all time.
Top 10, to be sure.
Honestly. But I wasn't done with just playing two Zelda games back to back.
No.
Obviously. And my gripe with the control setup inspired me to play a game which fixed this issue. And so I played the Switch remake of Link's Awakening. And essentially, this game is just a beautiful paint job of the Game Boy original, with many of the elements of the original game retained from its like world design, dungeon design, puzzle design, story, dialogue, everything. But it's all been tilt-shifted into a brand new toy box aesthetic that's lovely to look at, certainly when it's not moving, because the frame rate is all over the place when you start to move around, which is such a deeply frustrating thing. Like, I reckon if they'd have just locked the frame rate to 30 frames per second, it would have been fine, because it only reaches 60 frames per second for tiny brief moments, once or twice, maybe every few hours. It's just a really, really weird decision. Like, even if they'd have locked it to 25 frames per second, I'd have preferred that. What's not a weird decision, though, is to address this issue that I had with Minish Cap, and that is to properly utilise all the buttons on the Switch console, which is such a delight. So, in the Link's Awakening remake, previous items that needed to be assigned, like the power bracelet, which you use to lift things up, or the Pegasus boots that you use for running, your sword, your shield, all of those either have their own buttons or just become default abilities, which means you can use your two item slots for useful things like bombs or your boomerang or your hookshot or your rock's feather to jump around. And it just means that the game is so much smoother to play because you're not going in and out of menus every 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And it's a decision that makes me want a remake of Minish Cap in this style so much, because it would look even more adorable in this art style.
Tilt shift dog.
Tilt shift my dog, for goodness sake. How many times? I mean, perhaps we will get something like that on the Switch 2 when the frame rate won't be as inconsistent as my aging bowel. But at its core, the game holds up unbelievably well, Link's Awakening. It's over 30 years old now, and the game design is still just amazing. A few of the rough edges have been taken off in the remake, but really not, like, there aren't that many. The fast travel has been made just a bit easier and slicker. Autosave is a nice function. Some additional features in the game add a little bit more to do and make things a bit more streamlined, but honestly, this game is such a colossal achievement. I'm so glad it holds up so well. I did decide to stop there with my 2D Zelda binging. What other big chunks have you done?
This is a game I've played quite a lot of. I don't know how I came across it. I think it just must have appeared in my recommended list on Steam or something, but I'm glad it did. It's a game called Sociable Soccer.
Ah.
And it's a proper arcadey football game. And it's from the original developer of the classic Sensible Soccer from the Amiga 16-bit machines at the Mega Drive. And it's really good. It's really good. It is a simple three-button football game. It's got a direct pass, a long ball, and a shoot. When you're out of possession, every button instead triggers a slide tackle. And after you release a shot or a pass, you can then apply after touch using the analog stick to use the parlance of my brother, the football aficionado, give it some swaz. So there's a lot of swaz in this game. Sometimes hopeless keeper placement means you can bend in a shot from like 50 yards and feel amazing. Other times keepers will play out of their skin and somehow save or deflect 15 consecutive shots and rebounds, leading you to curse the AI and the entire game. But what remains really consistent throughout all of this is that the moment-to-moment play is just really fun. There's two main modes to play. One lets you play a range of real-world tournaments and leagues using actual club and national teams. A pretty vanilla experience where you're just trying to unlock trophies for the love of playing it, really. The other mode is far closer to the old Master League mode in Pro Evo, where you choose a club and you're then given a randomised selection of Z-list stars with which to try and achieve glory. And a run of good form means you unlock new players in the form of new cards. Excess cards can be melted down to improve your star players, etc. It's a bit mobile game in its setup, but there's no microtransactions here. You know, it's just good, clean fun. Every match in this mode is against another real-world player's team as well. So not as a live player versus player thing, but a kind of asynchronous setup. And it's interesting to see how different players have set up their clubs, kind of FIFA Ultimate Team style, to leverage little unwritten synergies and strategies and that sort of thing. So they're not playing with you, but their kind of planning is playing against you. Their AI team, as it were. I've played it and enjoyed it for quite a few hours at this point. But more tellingly, my brother Tom, as I've mentioned, who pretty much only plays football games outside of the odd thing that I managed to kind of get him addicted to, like Angry Birds or Plants vs. Zombies, he's also given it his seal of approval. So for now, at least, it's become the game that has followed our Plants vs. Zombies victory a few months back. And it is now the thing we play to kind of make progress in the background whilst we're having a takeaway pizza when we're kind of hanging out together. And I'm all for anything like that. It's one of my favourite types of games. It's like low effort on your part to engage with it, but there is a lot to do if you just want to kind of be endlessly picking away whilst you're kind of thinking about other stuff. As far as I can tell, looking online, it is slated for console releases at some point, but the launch seems to have been kicked back a few times, so I think it's only on the PC at the moment. It's not much of a looker, so any device right down to the Switch should be able to handle it no problem when it does release.
Yeah.
And I'd say it's definitely worth keeping an eye out for, especially if, like us, you've enjoyed stuff like New Star Soccer or New Star Manager or Retro Goal, you know, all the games in that series. Or indeed, if you remember fondly, like Sensible World of Soccer or Kickoff on kind of consoles going right back, it's just really good fun. Really, really good fun. Big recommend on that one. And it's constantly being updated and evolving as well. So you'll often see an update pop up on Steam. You read the notes and it says, goalkeepers have been made much better. And then all the comments are people saying, we hate the new goalkeepers. And then a new update will come the next day saying, goalkeepers have all been nerfed. It's quite nice to see that in live development as well.
Yeah.
Well, last month, and apparently this month as well, Chris turned in one of the biggest shocks this podcast has ever seen, with a proper finger on the pulse of the current gaming scene, reporting on Powerworld. To be fair, neither of us are ever really properly up to date with gaming trends or the zeitgeist, but this month I have been playing a huge amount of the current gaming mega popular super hit, Balatro.
Oh, you've got to sell me on this one, because I think I could enjoy it.
You will enjoy it, because I defy anyone not to enjoy it, because it's so enjoyable.
Well, there you go.
So for those of you who don't know about this game, Balatro is a new roguelike game based around the very straightforward mechanics of a game of poker. You get dealt a selection of cards, and you need to pick the highest scoring hand you can to hit the score target of each round to move to the next one. Value of the cards will score chips, and then a multiplier will be applied depending on what type of hand you've played, with things like, you know, flushes and straights scoring more than pairs and two pairs, and then full houses, four of a kind, straight flushes, royal flushes, that sort of thing, having higher multipliers. You'll have a certain amount of hands to do this in, and you'll also have a certain amount of discards that you can use to get rid of your cards you don't want and pick some fresh ones to try and build the hand that you want. So far, so much like poker. But then, between rounds, you get to visit a shop to buy new cards. And here we see the game come to life. And, I mean, first and foremost, you have five Joker slots to fill with a variety of different Joker cards that are basically your bread and butter augmenters. And these range from everything from, like, increasing your multiplier for playing cards of a certain value or a certain type or a certain suit, additional chips being awarded for playing certain hands or certain cards, Jokers that help accrue more money so that you can spend more money in the shop, and then even more extreme and weird Jokers with more complex conditions that work in tandem with other Jokers. And it just allows you to start to construct potentially just incredibly powerful builds that work for how you want to play the game, taking you from playing hands worth a couple of hundred points to millions over the course of several rounds. If you can keep hitting, you know, the targets, clearing rounds, clearing the bosses that come at the end of a round as well. Bosses have got like certain abilities that limit how you're playing. They might like debuff all of the cards of a particular suit, or disable a Joker, or start dealing some of your cards face down. Then on top of that, you get planet cards to increase the base value of certain hand types. You get tarot cards that can enhance the cards in your deck, giving them special abilities to make them worth more chips or increase multipliers or give more money or trigger all kinds of other abilities if they're played or if they're discarded. Or if you hold them in your hand, then you can also buy vouchers which apply abilities to your whole run. Then you've got different starter decks that you can choose from that come with certain starting abilities. And your overall aim is to clear a run of like 8 rounds. And a round is like small blind, a big blind, and a boss blind with one deck. That's your run beaten. But then you can also at that point decide to keep going, face an endless mode, see how high you can get, you know, with the rounds anti-upping the target scores exponentially. As with a lot of roguelikes, it sounds like there's a huge amount going on in Balatro, and there is, which is why the game is so deep and fun to keep playing for so many dozens of hours. But there's never been a point where I felt overwhelmed by all of the mechanics because of a few things. Just how simple the core design of the game is. Just play a poker hand. You don't even need to know your poker hands because you can just press a button and it will show you the poker hands and, you know, rank them and how good they are.
Yeah.
You build your jokers up one at a time to help your style of play. After you start doing a few runs, you start to become more familiar with various cards that could turn up. You start to target them in your mind, and you're building the complexity one bit at a time. So it's never all of this stuff at once. And crucially, at all times, there's always little pop-up boxes telling you what everything does. So you don't even need to retain basically any information. even down to like the different specific card enhancers. You don't need to worry about what a foil card does, or a glass card, or a polychrome card, or a stone card, or a lucky card, or what like a blue or gold or red or purple seal on the cards mean, because there's always the information available to you. It's wonderfully, wonderfully comforting. And there's obviously shit tons of stuff to unlock in Balatro.
Of course.
Hundreds of different jokers that can become added into your game. And you can see their unlock conditions in the game that almost work as achievements. It's something you can target to do on your next run. They probably do work as achievements if you're not playing the game on Switch. Which I'm not, actually. I'm playing it on Steam because... but I turned off notifications on Steam, so I don't know if I'm getting achievements or not, because otherwise I worry I'll just get obsessed.
Yeah.
But also, unfortunately for my productivity, the game also runs on Mac through Steam, so I can have a game going all the time when I'm working,
yeah,
and then keep playing when I'm on the sofa in the evening. It's Hooray. Horrifically dangerous because it is so incredibly addictive. And also because, like, it's not an action game like pretty much every other roguelike I've played. It doesn't demand my full attention at any time because I can allow myself to be distracted and not get killed but also it can totally absorb my full focus and attention too. It's amazing how simple and accessible this game is. Yeah. If you're not a fan of roguelikes, you will like this game. I can't think of a type of gamer that wouldn't enjoy this, apart from somebody that goes, I don't like things that are good.
They are out there.
They are out there. And like today, at point of recording, they just announced that it's sold 1 million copies.
Fair play.
It's not cheap as chips. It's, you know, 10, 15 quid, something like that. It's worth every single penny of that. And it is available on everything. But like, clearly, so many people are playing it and enjoying it and loving it. And it's just brilliant. It's great fun. I can't recommend it highly enough. If you like games, if you like roguelikes, if you don't like roguelikes, if you don't like games, you'll like
still
this game.
Give it a go.
Easily my game of the year so far. Easily. Around the world in 80 games.
New Zealand!
New Zealand!
Hey! New Zealand!
I know, right? I know. Who'd have thought? Do you know what? It's mad, and this is definitely a zeitgeist thing, but today I read an article that in New Zealand they are issuing a whole range of special postage stamps celebrating the gaming history of New Zealand.
Oh, wow. I should have just looked at that. It would have saved me doing my research.
Isn't that ridiculous? I've never seen that done. In any country.
Certainly not on the day that we're recording this
episode. On the day
that
we're recording it from a country that is seriously not known for video game development.
No.
It's more well known for, you know, well, I could tell you. Do you want to know some facts about New Zealand?
Yeah. Go on. Lay it on us.
Population, just over 5 million. Capital city of Wellington.
Mm. Yeah.
Classic fact about New Zealand is that there are about 10 times more sheep living there than people, which is understandable.
Nice.
Because the sheep don't have to pay to live there.
Yeah.
Which also proves that sheep are smarter than snakes, because there are no snakes in New Zealand at all.
I like that. I'm not a fan of snakes.
Another fact is that the steepest residential street in the world is in New Zealand, which is a slope of 19 degrees, which is horrible to consider.
Christ, yeah.
Here's a good one. For a short period of time, the New Zealand badminton team were known as the Black Cocks. It's true. It was done as a marketing ploy, only lasted for about a year.
Yeah.
And of course, in the culinary world, it can only be known as a beef Wellington if it is from the Wellington region of New Zealand. Otherwise, it should technically be known as a sparkling steak bake.
I had a steak bake for breakfast.
I knew a Greg's Base joke would go down well
with
you.
Yeah, love it.
Tell me about the gaming history of New Zealand, Chris.
Well, if you want the abridged version, go and buy the stamps. If not, I will do my best to sum up some of it here. New Zealand has been an interesting country to research because in terms of games, the pool of notable titles is quite a lot smaller than some of the other locations that we've visited recently. Yet, surprisingly, I knew way more of them by name and often by having actually played them than any other country so far. So if we start with one of the biggest names, Pikpok, which were formerly known as Sidhe, have been running out of Wellington, New Zealand since the mid-90s. In that time, they've released a huge range of games based on their own intellectual property, as well as plenty of licensed IP on consoles, handhelds, mobile, the full works. They made things like Flick Kick Football. They made Into the Dead. They made Monsters Ate My Condo, three classic iOS and Android franchises. They're all from Pikpok. And going a bit further back, they were also responsible, for better or worse, for the Jackass tie-in game on the PS2 and PSP. This is not amazing. The Speed Racer tie-in game for the Wii and PS2, which was pretty good. DreamWorks Madagascar Kart, not Blade.
Surprised, actually.
And a whole bunch of officially licensed rugby titles, because New Zealand like rugby.
Oh, yeah.
There's a few more of their titles worth mentioning too, but I'm going to save them for a little bit later on, because I'm going to give you a bit of a deep dive into some Pikpok goodness. Designer Dean Hall, most famous these days for the mod that became its own standalone game, DayZ, started his career at Pikpok's Forebear City as well before going solo. It's not a game I've played, but I think it's pretty notable in that without it, I don't believe the Battle Royale genre would have existed at all as we know it today, because a lot of the gameplay that's come to define the core of PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds and then was stolen for Fortnite, you know, arguably comes from the groundwork that was laid down in DayZ. Hundreds of people on one map surviving, killing each other, looting goods, getting better weapons. It's the same thing. Ninja Kiwi, a reasonably high-profile Flash developer, are from Auckland in New Zealand, and their biggest hit, the Bloons Tower Defense series, is still resonating with people today, because I teach kids, literally now, contemporaneously, who obsessively talk about Bloons strategies, which kind of blows my mind a bit, because the franchise started back in the mid-2000s and yet still carries some cultural and digital cachet with kids two decades on. And
that's mad.
That's something to celebrate, I guess. Mini Metro and Mini Motorways, two mobile puzzlers that I know you are not a huge fan of. I know you weren't a huge fan, but they caused a reasonable stir on iOS, and they were both New Zealand developed. A game called Reverie, which I first played on the Vita. It's a bit Earthbound, it's a bit top-down Zelda, but it's definitely worth a look if you like kind of cutesy action-adventure games, and naturally, comes from New Zealand. More recently as well, A Medieval, a kind of spiritual sequel to the sorcery-based Doom like Hexen, Ashen, a sort of Dark Souls-y open world game published by Annapurna. They're both from the land of the Kiwi as well. As I've alluded to, my focus this month is on a game from Pikpok, but I understand that you submerged yourself in the murky depths for something a bit different.
I did.
By playing what?
Dredge.
Tell us about Dredge.
It's a game that I'd had my eye on for a little while. I was really, really pleased to get the opportunity to play it in this last month, and I've had a really, really good time with it. So what is Dredge?
Dredge
is a psychological, existential horror fishing game.
Yes.
You play as a washed-up castaway in a strange area of semi-populated islands with no memory of your past or present, and you pledge your future to the mayor who saved your life and gave you the capacity to earn your right to live there by becoming a fisherman. And you meet a whole host of strange, sallow-skinned, haunted-eyed inhabitants of the various islands talking about just basically just various horrors and side quests. And you take your boat out every day to fish, always a fun mechanic. You find little fishing spots, you trawl in your catch before fitting it into your inventory, Resident Evil 4 style.
Oh, I'm going to buy it now.
Honestly, it's where the real game is. All the different fish in the game, they're all different shapes and sizes too. Oh, so man, it's always fun to see how you can fit everything you catch into your hold. Also, when your boat takes damage, you'll basically lose a square of inventory randomly from like somewhere, and then that will change the shape of things that you have to fit in and stuff like that. And it's just, it has no right to be as fun as it is doing that, but it is. Also find salvage to dredge up from the depths, like driftwood and machine parts and various treasures to sell. And you can sell your fish, you can trade in your goods, and you can upgrade your boat and fishing gear to be able to withstand the harsh conditions of the waters that you'll find as you start to venture out into the wider ocean. I'd say Dredge is a narrative game more than it is a fishing game.
Yeah.
But then the fishing mechanics and the upgrade mechanics and the inventory mechanics, they're all just really, really good fun and really addictive. But this is a game that places atmosphere as the sort of the prime component to the player experience. It does this in many, many ways. Firstly, the writing and visual design of the characters and the lands you discover, they're just brilliantly grotesque and spooky. It's obviously taking a lot of leaves out of H.P. Lovecraft's book for the ungodly, fishy weirdness of it all. And it couples this with just some of the best and most evocative sound design I've heard in a game in a long time. It's one of the rare games that I've played on the Switch with headphones in, because it creates such an immersive experience when you're channeled in to all the sounds of this strange world. And then when night falls in the game and you start to witness the horrors that you've only heard whispers of, it's genuinely scary. And what is an H.P. Lovecraft-inspired game without a sanity system?
Oh, naturally.
Naturally. It's got a fantastic sanity system. It's one of the best I've seen in a game, certainly since Eternal Darkness basically came up with the idea. So you have a sanity meter that will start to be compromised the more you're exposed to the darkness of the night or seeing weird stuff, or the longer you go without sleep. and you'll start to manifest dangerous hallucinations that can cause you to damage your boat by running aground on phantom rocks or being chased by ghostly leviathans. And like these sort of gimmicks, they're always woven in quite organically. It's not like I'm fine, I'm mad. It's just like something will happen and you go, is that real? I don't know. And then, yeah, like all of these like aberrations, they're all like peppered throughout the game at all instances, like whether or not it's a shipwrecked sailor gone mad who's filling your head with tall tales, or the literally like dimensionally warped fish that you'll sometimes catch, are both fascinating and stomach churning. No matter how much you upgrade your boat, how much light you can shine in the darkness, how fast you can move, you never feel safe. There are five main archipelagos that you can explore, with many extra pieces of land strewn in the sea between them all. They all have their own type of atmosphere as well, whether or not it's like the tornado-infested rocks of Gale Cliffs, where at any point the wind can start to carry your boat dangerously close to the rocks, or you've got like the winding, poisonous mangrove maze of the Twisted Strand, or the ancient ruins poking their heads out of the boiling volcanic waters in the Devil's Spine. They're all home to just an amazing amount of unique creatures, and they all require sort of various different upgrades and approaches to be able to navigate them without succumbing to the depths. Say it's a narrative game, because, I mean, there is a story, sort of a story going through the game based around one central quest of having to retrieve a certain sunken treasure from each of these main archipelagos. But the real story is just exploring this world and its lore and talking with these people and just doing these side quests and filling in these bits and discovering all of the secrets and the horrors. The actual main game, as it were, was quite a bit shorter than I was expecting. I rolled the credits after a dozen or so hours, but there's still so many side quests I need to complete. There's about 100 different fish to catch in the game. There's also crabs that you can catch with using crab pots. And then all of those fish have these grotesque, aberrated forms of them as well. So there's double that amount of everything. And each of these as well, like you can catch in trophy variants as well.
Big boys.
Yeah, big old big boys. There's also DLC with like a new area to explore. There's plenty of scope to keep expanding the game with new areas and new content. Just keep adding it to the ocean. Just keep making it bigger. It's a really, really good game. If the atmosphere and story wasn't as compelling as it is, it wouldn't necessarily go down as like an all-time classic fishing game. But that gameplay is still really, really good and fun and addictive. But I think it's one of the risks you get when you make a game that's quite open, that kind of just lets you do what you want. I feel like the balance wasn't quite there between like the two different games it's juggling, the fishing and the narrative stuff. I found like myself having pretty much upgraded my boat and my reels and unlocking loads of stuff before I felt like I'd explored that much. But that's very probably a me problem, because I just approached the game in this way and other people might not have done. And other people might have been a bit more gung-ho, charging off into the night and not batting an eyelid at all of the monster-infested waters. But then, you know, I was a little bit more cautious and I was staying back. And yeah, that is the risk of making a game like this. If you take the reins off, obviously people can go in any direction they choose, which can be very, very liberating. But it's ultimately going to be a less curated adventure because of that.
Yeah.
Fortunately, in Dredge, whatever you're doing, however you're approaching playing this game, everything is really, really fun. And it's just a brilliantly well-realized atmosphere to immerse yourself in. I highly recommend it. I played it on the Switch, holds up really, really well. I mean, the art style is gorgeous and it performs really smoothly on the Switch. It's not hitting 60 frames per second, but it's locked at 30, I think. And it goes for that one long load time approach at the start of your session. Yeah. And then you don't experience any loading while you're playing, even if you're fast traveling. It's just there, which is really,
nice.
Really good.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a good game. It's a really atmospheric time. Recommend.
Wow.
New Zealand. Spooky, fishy weirdos.
I've got another game to recommend from New Zealand.
Tell me about it.
Back when Pickpock was still known as Sidhe, that I mentioned earlier, they released a couple games that I was a really big fan of. The first was called Grip Shift, and it was a driving game that launched on the PSP and then later digitally via Xbox 360 and PS3. And it essentially asked the question, what if a driving game could also be a platformer and a collectathon? And that's what it does. And every track asks you to beat it in three ways. So you have to hit the finish line under a par time. You need to collect all the tokens that are spread across the track. And you need to find a hidden collectible that will usually require you to launch off the main road and onto bits of trackside architecture or floaty islands that surround the race course. And it's really good. And for a while, I thought I was just going to play through it again for this month's show and talk about it. You know, I found out the PS3 port emulates perfectly on the deck. I threw a good few hours into it in one sitting, had a lovely time. And then when I sat down to make some notes, I thought, outside of just describing what you do in the game, which I've just done, there isn't that much to say.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fun time. I really enjoy playing it, but I can't really go any further than that. Reviews of the time basically were the same as well. It was a lot of just, this is what you do, and it's okay. You know? I still think it deserves way better than the middling scores it got.
Yeah.
It was a very kind of like average across the board, and I think it's way better than that. But I thought I'd cover a different game from Pickpocket Past instead, because whilst playing Gripshift in 2024 relies on emulation, the game I'm going to talk about properly is available pretty much everywhere via its 2022 remastered deluxe release. And that is a game called Shatter.
Ooh.
Now, Shatter, originally released in 2009, it was a PlayStation 3 exclusive for a year or so. And this is a game that asks the question, what if Alleyway or Breakout or Arkanoid or whatever sort of frame of reference you have could feel less random? And it answers it really nicely. It was a lot of fun 15 years ago when I first played it. And would you believe it? It's a lot of fun today.
Mm.
And because it's had this remaster, you can get it on your phone, you can get it on your Switch, you can get it on your Xbox or your PlayStation. And naturally, as the way I've been playing it, you can get it on Steam for your personal computer or handheld gaming device. When you start Shatter, it just looks like a Breakout game, but with a retro wave or futurist aesthetic. But you very quickly realize that a lot has been done to the core of it to make it all about player agency instead of exploiting kind of wonky physics that is what Breakout normally is. So for one, your paddle is curved rather than flat. And without any other additions, this would make the game more readable because you quickly get a feel for the direction the ball is going to reflect on impact. For two, you were shown pretty early on that the left and right triggers on your control pad control a sort of vacuum push or pull system, whereby you can arc the ball's motion even when reasonably far away from your paddle. So you can kind of add spin or bend. For three, Breaking Blocks releases little gems, and when these are collected, it allows you to build a multi-use meter that can either trigger a shield to glance away Meanie Bobini projectiles or a machine gun that lets you destroy swathes of blocks quickly, which is perfect for the last few hangers-on that would lead to several minutes of dead time in most brick breakers where you're just waiting for the perfect angle to align. And for four and for final, you can chuck balls out willy-nilly. So multi-ball is always at your discretion and control. And on a board that would favour a more kind of all-over approach, just throw them out. If you've got eight balls in stock, just chuck them all out. You know, as long as you have them, fill your boots. All this leads to an incredibly engaging and exciting arcade brick breaker. Like, most people enjoy brick breaking games because they are satisfying at their core. But most people also would say, there's not much to it, though, is it? It's just reflecting a ball. But this does enough different that I think it really stands out. Several other games that came out close to Shatter's original launch tried to explore similar variables to kind of spice up the genre. So you can think WizOrb, if you ever played that, or Break Quest was on the Vita, I quite enjoyed. Both of them are good, but Shatter is way better. It's more polished, it's more considered, and because of the particular tweaks and changes, it's just a lot snappier.
Yeah.
I think it says a lot that Atari, they've been doing this recent recharged line of updated kind of classic arcade games. They put out Breakout Recharge, which is, you know, Breakout is essentially the godfather of this genre.
Mm.
And it takes cues from Shatter's aesthetics, but it doesn't really modernize the gameplay itself beyond power-ups. It's still a flat paddle. You're still moving slowly left and right. The stages could still be a tired old trudge as you're just waiting patiently for the ball to reflect just right. It's annoying. It is annoying. As soon as you play a version where you're like, it doesn't have to be annoying, it is annoying. You know, in Shatter, you always feel like you have more control than the game does. And that's a really impressive thing, I think, for this framework. So stages never linger more than they need to. Boss encounters every 10 stages are exciting. Stage layouts and quirks are refreshed often enough that it never feels stale. And the game can feel appropriately challenging without ever feeling impossible. So you can get through it at a clip if you're just playing to beat the game, and you'll have a lovely time. But then if you do fancy chasing scores, you're well accounted for that as well, because the score mechanics are all transparent and gameable. And the control options like the push and pull system become less just a nice thing to have when you first start playing and more tools to actually directly influence the flow of the board or a level. I really, really like this game. I think it's fantastic that it was resurrected for the modern re-release. And outside of upping the resolution and affording support for like super high refresh rates if your PC supports it, Shatter Remastered Deluxe is essentially just Shatter, but more widely accessible.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I think it's that's the sort of time, like, as an example, I've literally just said, Gripshift is not accessible anymore. There's no reason why that couldn't be tarted up and sold for a fiver on Steam or on the Switch or whatever. It's a decent game. And I think more developers, if they lean back into their own catalogues and think about, you know, Castle Crashers got remastered not that long ago just to make it accessible again. Scott Pilgrim got relicensed and is now available again. These are all games from that era. I think because they launched primarily for digital devices, will just be gone unless people kind of put in a bit of time and marketing to kind of get it available again. So yeah, I think it's good. And the fact that more people than ever can give this one a go means I think that, you know, the Brick Breaker will live on, because this is probably one of the best examples of what you can do with the formula. So yeah, Pickpop, Sidhe, whoever you're calling him at the time, another New Zealand triumph to round out this episode.
So there we go. That's New Zealand in a nutshell.
Oh yeah.
Where are we going next, Chris?
We are going to take another long old trip. Although in my mind, I'm thinking long old trip from here in the UK.
Yeah.
But from New Zealand, maybe not quite as far. We're going to South America. We're going to check out the games of Brasilia. We're going to Brazil.
Ooh, fantastic. That is exciting. That's very exciting. I cannot wait to find out what games have been made in Brazil. Pick one and play one and then report back next month.
That's the rules.
So there we go. That was Around the World in 80 Games, Episode 5, New Zealand. Really enjoyed that. Really good games, really interesting gaming development as well. Oh, hope you've enjoyed it if you're listening this far. Chat to us on the Discord, o3c.games, find the link there. Follow us on social media at o3cgames on everything. Give us suggestions of countries you might like us to go to next. Give us suggestions of games to play. Tell us what you're playing. Talk to us about anything else. We'd love to hear from you. Same time next month, 1st of May.
Yeah.
Going to Brazil. Yeah. Just in time. Ha ha ha!